Welcome to the Perp Web Podcast, hosted by Joe Bosch.
All right, coronavirus implications for perfusion. So my experience, and I took the twist on this of what is my experience as a perfusion practice manager, a perfusion company business owner. I really don't know how to put it. I just went ahead and put it as a business owner. But this whole episode, when it first started out, created a tremendous amount of uncertainty for me. I was concerned at first, but I was really sort of anticipating what's gonna happen. I didn't know, to be honest with you. Some of me was like, well, it's not gonna be that bad here. We contained it, it's somewhere else. Kind of like what SARS and MERS did, And so I was sort of, planning for the worst, but really hoping for the best. But even though I was doing a lot of planning as it got worse and worse and worse, I do have to say this. I think it had it gotten really, really, really bad. I mean, I'm talking Lombardy, Italy bad. At those, that level where we were putting everyone on ECMO that we could. It wouldn't have mattered how much I planned. I don't think any system, regardless of who it was, big academic institution, big giant national perfusion company, smaller perfusion practice regionally like us, or even a smaller hospital-based program, no one could have handled it, frankly. I don't believe. Okay. But we did a lot of planning. And at some point, we activated our disaster plan. After we activated the disaster plan and we made several requirements in that, or several, things, I can't think of the word I'm looking for, we made adjustments as the CDC. I'll give you an example. We had two people who we knew had contact with a COVID patient. However, that contact was only when the clinicians were in full PAPR suits. So was that a contact? And we had no guidance from the CDC at that point in time. So it was assumed they were. So those two people were removed from our system completely and only taking care of that one patient in that one hospital, unless another COVID patient had been put on ECMO in that hospital, then the two would have had to manage each shift two patients. But then I was thinking, well, what's the limitation here? Well, we could use our heart-lung machines. Could we use the oxygenator out of the pump pack? Because we had already stopped doing elective heart surgery. Elective heart surgery shut down. We'll kind of go over all of that. But again, it kind of flows back to all of this was happening, but I still had a tremendous amount of uncertainty as to where was this going to go. And I think one of the things uncertainty brings out in people is fear. And I had my fears. Now, you learn to control them and you process them and you manage them. But I still was fearful. What is going to happen here? I just didn't know. We did a lot of adjusting, as I said, once CDC came out and said if the patient was intubated or you were in a PAPR suit or both, that was not considered a contact. The contact had to be specific criteria that or not. If you didn't have that criteria, you technically did not have a contact. And then reevaluating what we were doing at the time and what was happening. So there was a lot of activity that was going on, trying to figure out what is happening here, what are we going to do? Well, I understood that we had certain things that we had to do. we had to provide a high level of essential care. That couldn't go away. We had to be able to do that. We also have contractual obligations. We have contractual obligations. We also have ethical obligations. But if you're an employee of a hospital, it's not a contract in the sense I'm talking about. We as a business have a business contract with this hospital to provide people, but you still have an employment agreement. Mm-hmm. And there's rules and regulations that govern this kind of thing that you have to follow. So we're all operating under some type of contractual obligation. I had to keep all of us, the team members, myself, safe and healthy. People were scared, understandably. They didn't know how bad this disease was going to actually get. And we're in that unique position that we live in the world of being exposed to all kinds of things whenever we go into the bloodborne pathogens. We're around sick patients all the time. Hospitals are just a breeding ground for infectious diseases. So we're in the hospital all the time, but this was unique and definitely different. We had to manage different hospitals, and different hospitals enacted different policies. Some said if you had a contact, it's 2 weeks, you can't come into the hospital. Others said it was 30 days. Had you traveled out of the country or a cruise ship, there were limitations to when you could come back to work. And each one was different. There was only so many options, but each hospital was either 2 weeks or 30 days. Most were 2 weeks, however, I will say that. We had to limit the number of team members that were exposed to that patient in case it ended up. They changed the rules because I got to think about that too. Just because the rule today is X doesn't mean the rule's not going to be Y tomorrow. So I had to consider that. We had to set up lines of credit for payroll because people can't live without being paid. That was a serious issue. When you take all of the elective cases away, and when hospitals go into essentially a lockdown and not have any of their non-essential staff come in, guess who is not considered essential? Accounts payable. You can wait. So now you're confronted with that problem. So you don't have money coming in, but you still have people that need to be taken that need to be paid, and the manufacturers aren't going to ship things if you're behind on them. So it becomes very complicated, very stressful. There's no question about it. We evaluated the financial impact. We did that several times. In fact, we did it several times, sometimes in a day. We interacted with administrators, particularly those of smaller hospitals that may close and did. We had to find things for the team to do. As this evolved, we saw how bad it really was going to get, which wasn't nearly as bad as we had at that point been prepared for. Now we've got people who are essentially not doing anything. Mm-hmm. And I think that most of us are adults. Most of us know what we can or can't do. But you know, as an organization, I think that it was, for me, it seemed helpful. And I think we're going to have at some point in time some really neat pictures from people who did a variety of things. They donated blood at the blood bank because blood was definitely at a shortage. Okay, people weren't donating. They were afraid to go. They didn't want to get infected at the blood bank. People were delivering meals, people were cleaning their neighborhood streets, they were doing things. They were socially distanced, you know, because they were the only ones out there cleaning the street, but they were doing something to be productive and also getting involved in educational programs like this. Tammy, that was the direction Tammy went, and we appreciate her just tremendously. She's got great perspective on a lot of different things with your experience. We followed the news and trends very carefully. In fact, I became a news junkie. I'm not sure that was really helpful. It's hard to say because the messaging was mixed every time I looked at something. There wasn't a lot of good coordination in terms of this is the message, one place to go, and it's unvarnished or it's not slanted, or the news was not good as far as I'm concerned. We needed, they didn't need to be doing these press releases or these press, what do they call that, where they get out? Press briefings. Mm-hmm. They needed to have a coordinated message. This is what's going on. These are our recommendations. Keep them short. I think what they did was for me, in this type of business that we're in, wasn't helpful. I had to keep a positive and optimistic attitude. And that wasn't necessarily the easiest thing for me to do. But I truly do believe that people will look to their leadership. And if their leadership is negative, falling apart, not managing their stress well, you'll find that the staff typically follows that same thing. I mean, we see it in sports teams. We see it in the military. We see it, you know, anytime there's a team, the leadership really matters. In fact, I made this comment too on Saturday. If you go to a hospital, and I've done it many times, and you find a bunch of, you're in the operating room and everybody is cohesive and people get along and they're friendly with each other and they're friendly to you and helpful and genuinely appear like they're happy to be there, you can almost guarantee that the administration of that hospital, the director of that unit, supervisor, director, and then the administration of that hospital are really promote, they foment that kind of attitude. They're themselves open and thoughtful and polite and respectful. You find that, I think, hands down. But when you go into a place that is malignant and everybody is trying to stab somebody in the back, including you, and they're hateful, and I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen it before in your career, I have.
Sure.
Almost inevitably, that's what the leadership of that facility is.
Or and, that's what the leadership tolerates too, if they have employees that are malignant or negative, mm-hmm. and they don't do anything about it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and they will bring down everyone. That is absolutely true. That's a good point. And I did a lot of praying. So for those of you out there that know me, you know that I'm somewhat, you know, I guess the term is agnostic. I want to believe in something bigger than us, but I'm not an organized religion kind of guy. And I think that God, so I do believe there's a God, and that he's busy. There's a lot happening all the time. So I figure if I don't pray that often, like I don't pray for everything. But when I do, he thinks, huh, that guy Joe, he never asks me for anything. But I was asking this time. I was doing a lot of praying because we needed to get that PPP, and we had that application filled out and ready to go before it was even open. And we did. We were successful at that. But that was a lot of work to put all of that information together because it's based on your previous year's information, and everything, every box had to be checked. Every I had to be dotted, every T had to be crossed. You could not have a mistake. You can't have a comma in the wrong place. We're talking about the government, okay? Uh-huh. So that's how they work. Okay, so let's see, go to the next slide. I'm back on my side, thanks. There were a lot of special considerations. This was different than a natural disaster. When you have an earthquake, or you have a hurricane, or you have a tornado, it comes, it wreaks havoc, mm-hmm. and it's gone. Of course, an earthquake, you don't know it's coming. But basically, you know, when it's over, it's over. Hurricanes, you know they're coming. Tornadoes, you get a little bit of a warning. Mm-hmm. But they generally come through. Now, they can be devastating. But again, you can see it. You know it exists. It's somewhat tangible.
It has a timeline, usually.
And it comes and it goes. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's not invisible. It's not submicroscopic, okay, where you need an SEM just to see the doggone thing. This was infectious. Now, we are in medicine, therefore we have a special responsibility. We take an oath, and that is a very serious thing. We have a responsibility to people who cannot help themselves. But we are human, and we have families, that we love. So we don't want to die, albeit we put ourselves in that position willingly, but we don't want our families to die. So we go to the hospital. Well, does this mean I can never go home? What considerations do I have to make? What's the risk that I'm going to bring something like this home and infect my wife, who's then going to die, or my parents or somebody? I mean, we just don't know. So my spouse would have been more appropriate. So those are things we need to take into consideration. The team also was afraid and worried. This will have, if we had to furlough people, if we had to cut pay, if we had to go on rolling time off, you know, or whatever it may have been, that was going to have serious financial implications for people. It doesn't matter that we're high-level professionals. People live and get paid well. I mean, I think that's a fair statement to make. But people live to their means. Mm-hmm. And we don't know where somebody, what financial obligations people have before this happened. This just may be the worst time. They might have been able to weather it 2 years ago. They might have been able to weather it 2 years from now. But at this moment, for whatever reason, there's certain things happening that are going to really create a problem. And we also, you know, we do a lot of auto transfusion work, and there are people within our organization who simply could not cut it. That it would have been financially devastating for them. And I realize that. Staff will certainly look to leadership for direction and encouragement. And with rare exception, healthcare workers always do rise to the occasion. And so I think that's something that I've learned through all of this is everyone, though there were considerations, there were concerns, there were worries, and there were fears, everyone in our organization, once they understood what needed to be done to protect themselves, was more than willing to do that. And there is that responsibility as well. We all, the leadership of the organization, but of the hospitals and the director of the medical staff, directors and officers, they need to make sure that the staff is safe, because if you lose the people who are there to take care of those, the people that are sick, and they become patients themselves, we're in a lot of trouble because there's already too few of us to begin with. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, let's see, I must have gone too far. Yeah. So, what we did once we had a known COVID case, it came very early in the process. We had a positive COVID-19 patient going on ECMO early in this disaster, before the shutdown. Mm-hmm. Okay. Simultaneous to the case was several hospitals sending out the notices that anyone that traveled out of the country could not come to their facility for 2 weeks to 30 days. That knocked out one of our people. Boom, out, gone, out of the system, because they had just come back from a cruise. We activated the disaster plan, as I said. We immediately canceled all vacations or time off. Everyone was on call until further notice. Restricted the number of people managing the COVID patient. Separated the group into teams and possible and responsible for one hospital. So given the total number of hospitals we had, given the total number of staff, we divided everybody up into teams and said, this team at this hospital, this team at that hospital, so forth, and went around and covered all of our contractually responsible facilities to make sure that I had people who could go to that institution repeatedly. Now, the hours would have been rough, because it would have been basically 12-hour shifts across the board, but such is medicine, and such is managing pandemics that may require our involvement. We eliminated any unnecessary travel to any hospitals. So as a private contract group, we have things we are responsible for to do. We didn't do those. If there is not a reason to travel to the hospital, don't go. That's just going to increase exposure risk. Made no sense whatsoever to do that. And then as the CDC was releasing more and more information, we eased our restrictions and took guidance from both the CDC and hospital regulations. We also assessed how many ECMO cases could we actually handle. And that is actually a fixed number. I can answer that question. Now, with the caveat, if you wanted to try to do ECMO with a roller pump, we could have perhaps done more than the fixed number. I did not consider that as a viable option. I think that carries with it too high a risk and would have been imprudent. That's my view, but what say you on that? I'm kind of curious what your view on that is, because that was a decision that I actually made.
I agree with you, especially if you're specific to our practice. We don't use roller head pumps for normal bypass cases. So there's a skill there that's not used very often anymore,
mm-hmm.
certainly not by our team. Now, if you were in a practice, you know, a pediatric practice or something that is accustomed to using roller pumps, I don't know, maybe they could have considered it, but I think your choice was the safest choice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, my concern was that if we take a bunch of isolated roller pumps, that's a good point that you had, and that was one of the considerations. But in addition, there's no way to integrate negative and positive pressure limiting because we only have so many heart-lung machines. So you could have four roller pumps, but you only have one place to be able to measure pressure in four different systems.
Well, you could use perhaps some kind of other pressure manometer or something of that sort, you know, an old dial style mm-hmm. or something, which I've seen on, you know, back mm-hmm. in the day on ECMO pumps. Mm-hmm. But if you don't have the pressure, then you're certainly mm-hmm. got some safety issues mm-hmm. going on.
Well, given how often, and we do a fair amount of ECMO as a practice, given how often I have seen chugging in the line mm-hmm. from the single Avalon from hypovolemia or whatever the case may be, just or different positioning of the patient, the amount of damage that can be done with a 6-liter roller pump when you're not right there. And if we had that many ECMOs going, there would not be somebody right there.
You'd be managing multiple bedsides.
Yes, if we got to that point. So again, my fixed number is only with centrifugal pumps. Mm-hmm. I did not go into the roller pump. I just didn't think it was a prudent decision. Mm-hmm. But then we also have the question of, I had to count up how many oxygenators do we have. That included the ECMO packs we have, and it included the number of heart packs we had. And then I had to worry about, like, what happened with the earthquake in Italy.
Are we
going to have a problem getting them? Because if we're seeing that much, everyone's seeing that much, and just like ventilators, will there be enough?
Right.
Will there be a supply chain malfunction? Mm-hmm. So really it came down to, what do we actually have?
How long could it last?
What's available to us at the moment. And it is a fixed number. You know, mm-hmm. So at least I know what that number is now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's not nearly as high as one would think. It's pretty high, but it ain't that high. Because if we'd have gotten to that point, as I said from the very beginning of this presentation, I think we would have been overrun. If we would have started just putting everybody on ECMO, we would have had 40 and 50-year-olds all dropping and needing ECMO, failing ventilatory support and needing ECMO, we would have only been able to help so many. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The system would have fractured.
You can only plan for so much.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I actually consider myself a decent planner, but it could have gotten out of hand, and it could have gotten out of hand very easily. And I think I need to say that to people. I need to be aware of that. I think other people need to be aware of that, too.
Well, I think that's the same for everyone. You can only plan so much. Even the most experienced planner would have likely been overrun.
Yes.
At some point. Yes. Everybody would have been overrun at some point.
Yes.
But probably sooner rather than most people once they put it to paper, would be, they'd be surprised.
Listen, I was worried about heparin shortages.
Yep.
I was thinking, okay, we'll use Bivalrudin. Okay, well, how much of that do we have? Mm-hmm. Angiomax, how much of that do we have? It was starting to, like, you know.
Well, because it's not just one thing.
We were really starting to worry.
It's a supply problem. And when you have a supply problem, it's not just one supply.
Right, because you can't do ECMO without anticoagulation. Not going to happen.
Nope.
Not going to happen. Okay. However, and thankfully, we did not have nearly as much ECMO as I had anticipated. However, ICU beds, ventilators to a lesser degree, some important medicines, because propofol was nearly impossible to find. You know, they were going to, what's that other one called? What's that stuff called? I can't remember. Presidex. Yeah, Presidex and a bunch of other things. There were, of course, Versed, things like that. But toilet paper. I still don't understand what the issue with the toilet paper was. I just don't get it.
It's still kind of hit or miss if you even find it now.
What are they doing with it?
I don't know.
Yeah, it's concerning. Had ECMO been more used, this would have been a near impossibility. We would have been overwhelmed. Platforms, oxygenators, and trained personnel. Once it became apparent that we were not going to be like New York or Lombardy, that was great. But by then, elective case volume was essentially non-existent. And that's when we were doing nothing. Mm-hmm. We had done two COVID ECMOs. Ultimately, our practice did two in a pretty big area, where this is not a small area.
Right.
And of course, we also covered down the Southeast, which is, again, not a small area. We just did not see it. And Matt Warhoover was on the program on Saturday. He's from Vanderbilt. They have had none.
None?
They have not put one patient on ECMO.
And they're such a busy practice.
And exactly. But our normal ECMO volume has plummeted. Mm-hmm. We had no elective hearts. We had no elective ortho, spine, anything like that. The children's hospitals were essentially stopped doing any elective cases. And I'm going to get into that a little bit. But basically, it's just shut down. And people were literally doing nothing, sitting at home. And frankly, I was worried about our team, even though we're older, more professional, we sort of we're expected to process this kind of stuff. We're all still just human. Mm-hmm. And, people got involved in things. And I feel like I think that was helpful. I think that was a smart thing to do. Kept people informed, stayed in communication with people, didn't just isolate myself to a bubble.
Well, and it's a stress reliever
and hopefully
to
it's
stay
helpful.
Productive.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it gives you a sense of
I mean,
of
kids
worth.
Are home now, and, you know, there's a lot more things going
yes.
on.
Yeah, and you know, I had not even thought about that from the very beginning, to be frank with you. And yes, look at, for example, Patrick and Julie. Mm-hmm. They have kids in school. They're not in school anymore.
Yeah.
If they were both perfusionists, what would they have done?
Well, you know, Michael and I are in the same situation, both essential. Now, we don't have our young children all the time, but we had to figure out what would happen if, you know, he got really busy and I got really busy.
Yes.
And what we would do.
What do you do? I know.
What do you do?
Very interesting. But I think that's where having good lines of communication with your supervision really matters.
Well, and
I
think they had a plan.
Yes.
They had a plan.
And Stephanie, I think, you know, Stephanie is our manager here in Houston, did an exquisite job. In fact, I have to compliment her. She does our advertisements. So when you see the advertisement at the beginning of the show, that's Stephanie. And y'all need to send her a little note and tell her how great that is. She hates that ad for whatever reason. I love it. But I think y'all need to send her a note and tell her how great that ad is. So what about the implications for everyone else? Well, we talked about us. We talked about all of this. But, you know, there's a whole bunch of other people. Uh-oh, we lost her mic. There's a whole bunch of other people that have been affected by this. So when you look at the distribution of inpatient stays with and without operating room procedures, so patients that come into the hospital to have surgery or just into the hospital for some other reason, about 40%, and this is in 2014, it takes a long time for them to get these numbers available, so I don't have anything close to 2016 or 17 numbers, but I don't think it's changed a whole heck of a lot. There were 10 million plus admissions for operating for surgery, 25 million for non-surgery admissions. But that's 40% of all hospital admissions are for surgical procedures. Mm-hmm. That's an enormous drop when you take all elective procedures away. And what I thought was really interesting was 28.2% of that 40% of admissions, 28.2% of all surgeries done are in the high risk category, 65 to 84. Mm-hmm. So the people who we are isolating are the ones who normally need surgical services, but no surgical services are available to them. And we had, look, I'll tell you about a case, 52-year-old fella, was having chest tightness, couldn't breathe well, ultimately developed a fever, figured he had corona, didn't want to go to the hospital, waited a couple of days, comes into the hospital. He was fast-tracked as a COVID-19, put in isolation, decompensating, taken to the operating room to put an Avalon and do VV ECMO, made the decision to do a TEE, saw a grossly depressed ejection fraction, started postulating that, well, you know, you could get acute myocarditis with this. There was all these discussions, but there was a big pericardial effusion as well. Did a window, blood pouring out of the window. Made a decision to go VA ECMO, did a sternotomy. The patient had a giant myocardial infarction and had ruptured their right ventricle. All three times he was tested for COVID were negative. He ultimately did not have COVID, but he's on the VAD floor. He probably will survive, certainly needs a transplant. Not going to get one anytime soon, so he's basically on a permanent VAD until we get through this crisis. Mm-hmm. So I have firsthand experience both with COVID patient going on ECMO and a patient that did not have COVID. Remember, I talked about the consequences of all of this are far-reaching. It goes beyond that. Mm-hmm. You know, the government officials, you know, regardless of what your politics are, and I'm not going to get into politics certainly for this show, but they talk about the depression rate, the suicide rate, the alcoholism rate, all of the, or alcohol abuse, substance abuse in general, mm-hmm. all going up through this crisis. There's a lot of people that have been affected by this just as badly, not worse, not less, just as horribly as the people who contracted the disease and ultimately got very, very, very sick and may have made it or succumbed to it. Okay? A lot of people are getting it that don't even know they had it, but that's another topic for a different day, and that's going to have to be a different person giving that lecture. But there's a lot of interesting information out there about asymptomatic. Mm-hmm. Outcome or asymptomatic, being asymptomatic while harboring the infection, the virus,
yep.
and never displaying any symptoms
infectors.
At all. Yes, asymptomatic infectors, right? Or right.
Yeah.
Right. Thank you. So look here: percentage of inpatient stays that involved operating room procedures by patient characteristics. Males seem to have surgery more than females do. Again, by this, 60, almost 63% were between 45 and 84. Again, the high at-risk group. Here, you see the most frequent all listed operating room procedures, and this was very important to me because number 4 and 5 are hip replacement total or partial and PTCAs. Number 10 is fractured or dislocated hips or femurs, very common. And 14th, which is a lot lower than I thought it would be, was coronary artery bypass graft, and number 9 coming in 19th was heart valve procedures. Mm-hmm. But again, these are the patients who are going to need services that are not getting them. So during this period of time, you can do the math yourself. In 2014, there were 201,600 CABGs, 143,600 valve procedures. Add both of those together, divide it by 12, and figure out how many people who needed services could not get services during this pandemic when essentially all of it was shut down. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of people. And if you add the 465,400 PTCAs, that's a lot. A lot of people. Not to mention the hip replacements from falling, the people that need hip replacements because they can't walk and they're in excruciating pain. What's happened to these people? Mm. Now, I know they're coming back, but had this gone on for several months,
mm-hmm. What would we have done? What would they have done?
What would they have done? It's a very concerning question. Top 5 most frequent all listed operating room procedures by age group. Again, we see PTCA, laminectomies, hip replacement, number 3, 4, and 5 for ages 45 to 64. For ages 65 to 84 are hip replacement, PTCA, spinal fusion, and for 85 and above, you can see again, PTCA is in there. So really it's number 3 in all 3 of those sections. And I think that's extremely important to recognize. Most costly, so this goes to hospital revenue, number 3 through 7, hip replacement, PTCA, C-sections, coronary artery bypass, heart valve procedures, and number 9, treatment for fractured hips and femurs from falling. When you consider that 8 of the 10 highest, or 7 of 10 highest, costly, which means revenue for the hospital, were essentially shut down, you have to consider what impact this has had on our hospitals. And I know they have that bailout for them with the government or assistance through the government or whatever. There's no way it can match the revenue that they lost. It may take a little bit of the sting out of it, but there's no way. There's just no way. This is going to fundamentally change, in my view, how hospitals are run for the next several years. This is going to have long, in my opinion, this is going to have very long lasting impact on our overall healthcare system in this country. Okay, so we're gonna look at the survey results. Perfusion needs to demand, however, these things, in my view, without exception. We need more affordable, simplified ECMO platforms. Currently, the one we use that we're fond of mm-hmm. is being taken off the market, which I think is, or not taken off, they're no longer producing it, not taken off the market as if there's something
that
wrong with
negative.
It.
That sounds negative.
Yes, let me rephrase that.
Yeah.
They are, so nobody misquote me out there. They've stopped production of it for a more expensive iteration, mm-hmm. which I think is just
the
ridiculous.
The next generation.
It's not even the next generation, it's totally different. Mm. And I think it's a huge mistake. I think what we need are simplified systems that are more affordable, as opposed to maybe more simplified, but so much more expensive, and in my view, unnecessarily expensive. In fact, some of them that they think are more simple, I think our system is actually more simple.
Most simple.
More simple. Adoption of blended programs with ECMO specialists. I think this has to happen. because perfusionists, there's just not enough of us. If this had been a huge ECMO, if this would have been needed, if ECMO would have been the only thing that would have helped these patients, given the how many patients we saw, and ventilatory support was known to just not be effective,
it would have changed our profession.
There's no way we could have come.
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah.
No way. And it would have been less, it would have been far less safe for the patients. If we start this now and develop blended programs with perfusion oversight, education, ECMO specialists, and significantly increase the army of people capable of managing ECMO. If we don't do that now, the next time this happens, it's not on me, it's on y'all. Because I feel very strongly about this. We also need to start adopting telemedicine. Telemedicine is here to stay. Telemonitoring is here to stay. You can have one perfusionist managing four or six patients in, or even specialist, in four or six different locations with people that are trained to be able to respond to what they're asking for, and then, if necessary, call perfusionists in. But it will enhance the management of the patient, it'll enhance the safety, it'll enhance the therapeutic value of ECMO by having that trained set of eyes on the monitors, on the systems, being able to look at it. You really don't physically have to be there. You can be four to six other places all at one time being able to do that. And if we ever have another pandemic, another virus, it's a respiratory virus that requires that much ECMO and we don't have this ready to go, once again, it will be a disaster. Mm-hmm. We were on the verge of disaster this time. And we got away with it. But it could have gone the other way. So you want to throw those polls up? And we'll go over them? So I misspoke the other day. There were 48, not 148.
Of what?
But I think there's 66. Okay, oh. Good. So we have 66 respondents. So not as many as I'd hope, but still we got 66. Let's take a look at the first question. So I work in not surprising, 68% in a community hospital. We all know that most surgery is done in community hospitals. Mm-hmm. That's probably reflective and accurate. Okay. I practice in Washington, Harris. Indiana, Louisiana, Arkansas, Saskatchewan. Hey, up there in Saskatchewan, get hockey started again. The United States, so must be a traveler. Louisiana, Florida, Texas, Ohio, Virginia, Texas, Washington, Missouri, Georgia, Connecticut, Georgia, South Australia, Ohio, Indiana, Texas, Alberta, British Columbia, Brazil, welcome. Georgia, Illinois, Kansas, Colorado, Arizona, Montana, Texas, Missouri, Pennsylvania, Illinois, West Virginia, Canada, Georgia, now that's not the state Georgia, that's the country, Alabama, Texas, Georgia, Tbilisi, another Georgia, Ohio, Illinois, Mauritius, Ohio, Netherlands, Ohio, Texas, Missouri, California, oh my God, just scroll through that, Paris, France, Ohio. Lord, that's pretty good. That's a heck of a sampling. Geographically, that's a pretty good geographic sampling. Okay, I was excited about that. My program provides ECMO as an option. This surprises me. This actually, now these are the-
Higher than you thought?
Oh, much higher than I thought, yes. Mm-hmm. But that's, of course, of the respondents. So it doesn't surprise me in that regard. Had it been a bigger poll, I think there's a lot more that don't provide ECMO than do in the country. I mean, just look at where we are right now. Like from where we are right now, I know of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Are you counting hospitals in our area?
Yes, I know 50, well, it close, like regionally.
Yeah.
50% of the hospitals in within striking distance of this location where we currently are, do not provide ECMO service. And they're full-scale hospitals that do heart surgery, so that's the criteria.
Yeah, right, that would happen.
So I find it interesting that 86% of the respondents.
Or the people that might be interested in this program today.
This is true too, yes. Good point. Okay, next. If applicable, our ECMO volume has 61% stayed the same, 20% increased, 19% decreased. Ours decreased. Would you agree with that, or I think it has, it's decreased.
Yeah, I think it has, but you know ECMO, it's always in waves
but it's
anyway.
It's also not influenza season, it ended. Mm-hmm. I wonder how many of those suspected influenza cases that tested negative for influenza, didn't test positive for anything else, before we knew what COVID was, were actually COVID patients. I think it's been here longer than what we believe. Hmm. I think it's been around longer than what people think. Mm-hmm. I think it was here sooner than February or March. Okay, interesting. Where I practice, our normal heart volume is between 250 and 499, 39% or 32%, between 500 and 1,000, that's a big program, 21%, greater than 1,000, 20%, that's a big program. Between 100 and 249, 20%, less than 100, 8%. That's interesting, okay. Our elective open heart case volume has decreased by 44% entirely of the respondents. Greater than 50% reduction is 29%, less than 50%, 23%, not at all, 5%. That is remarkable. Where are the cases? Where did they go? What has happened to those people?
What are those patients doing?
Yes, what are they doing? Yes, did they die? Will we find out that the mortality rate for during this period of time for this particular disease went way up? And is it going to end up being higher than it was for the mortality of the coronavirus?
Or are they waiting and their surgeries are going to end up being more needed than they were because they've put it off?
Yeah, but let me throw this out at you. How many times have you heard, and I don't know if this is just hyperbole or not. I don't think it is, but yeah, maybe it is. Where the patient goes in and the physician says, it's a good thing you came in. Had you waited any longer, we would not have been able to help you. Mm-hmm. And they would have gone stage 3 to stage 4 cancer and died and been terminal. How many times? Have you ever heard that happen before?
Well, maybe not that exact wording, but the general meaning of that, sure.
Yes. Yeah, so what's happened to these people? You know, how many of those people are going to be harmed by this, afraid to come in? Look at the guy with the ruptured heart, the ruptured right ventricle. Yeah. Well, I think that's very telling. If applicable, some of our perfusion team has been, nothing has changed, 62%. That's, again, a large percentage. 15% were repurposed. I don't know what repurposed to what. I should have asked that.
Probably a hospital institution repurposed them.
Probably.
Yeah.
14% were furloughed and 9% were not applicable. Okay, next. If applicable, the entire perfusion was mandatory availability. 46% no, 42% yes. So we were in that 42% group. 12% was not applicable. And last poll, I think it's the last question.
That was it.
That was the last question. Well, that was very interesting. Would have liked to have had a higher number of respondents, but that's okay. It was still good. We figured to learn a better way of doing it. But I love that QR code now that I know you can do that, because you have to make it simple for people. If it's simple for people, they'll vote. You think that was too long?
No, but I think they need to know it's not going to be too long.
Yes, that it's very fast. I need to put that. You know, David should have put that on the notification that it's a very very short poll.
I'm not saying that. Less than 2-minute poll.
Okay. So there's my...